Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 8th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today he will be continuing his series on moral ecology. Today's session number is 6 and is titled Watching, the Moral Ecology of Television. Let's listen in.
I'm Jim Farrell, and this is a session called Watching, the Moral Ecology of Television. For some reason, scripture is mostly silent about television. Without vision, the Old Testament tells us the people perish, but that doesn't tell us about television. In Matthew and Mark and Luke, Jesus asks the disciples, "Can you not watch 1 hour with me?" But presumably, he was not talking about television. Just the same, I'd like to suggest that we watch an hour of TV here in this place where there are no TVs. Before we begin, I'd like you to think about where the TVs are in your home. For each TV, the average American household has 2, although I had a student once in a family of 4 whose family had 10. I want you to kind of sketch mentally a map of the furniture in the room and where the TV is. And I think that for most of us, what happens is you get a vision of a shrine that any anthropologist coming from a foreign world to the United States would think that this is something that we worship. And in fact, there's a wonderful book by David McCauley called The Motel of the Mysteries. The Motel of the Mysteries, which is a takeoff on the King Tut stuff. He discovers an American motel called the Tutankhamun Motel, and then tries to analyze all the meanings of the stuff in there. And he does think that in this motel setting, that this TV, which is, you know, all the beds all face the TV in motels, that this TV is a channel for worship. And there's channel A and channel B. Those are 2 ways to reach God. These are the kinds of interpretations that you get. And he does lovely drawings with them, with this too, including he thinks that the toilet seat is a kind of ritual headdress, and like actually Ned was wearing in the 4th of July parade. But anyway, as you can see, that TV in America is like a shrine with all of the furniture oriented worshipfully in its direction. And if you don't do that, actually people can get disoriented in your house. I once had a friend come to our house in a house where we had the TV really in a corner where it wasn't readily visible, and we would kind of pull it out when we wanted to watch it. And he was in there for about an hour, and he's looking around, "Wait, don't you have a TV?" And once I assured him that we did, he was able to rest again. But anyway, as one critic said, in America, TV is like religion, except we watch it more religiously. For my main text today, I would like to use the McKibben book, The Age of Missing Information, and an essay that was published in 1960 by American poet and critic Randall Jarrell, spelled J-A-R-R-E-L-L. I tend to like to pronounce it Gerald, because then it rhymes with Farrell, and I may do that from time to time today, but I think the correct pronunciation is Jarrell. It was published in 1960, and this essay analyzes the media in American culture, examines the relationship between the artist and American society, and discusses by implication the moral ecology of everyday life. 4 years before Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media popularized the idea that the medium is the message, Jarrell focused on the American media. He went, however, to the root of the matter, the word itself. He looked it up in the dictionary and found that medium means, quote, "that which lies in the middle, hence middle condition or degree, a substance through which a force acts or an effect is transmitted, any means, agency, or instrumentality as a medium of communication, any surrounding or pervading substance in which bodies move, hence an environment, or more specifically, a sterilized nutritive substance for cultivating bacteria, viruses, etc." Given this route, he claimed that all the media, television, radio, movies, newspapers, magazines, and the rest, are a single medium in whose depths we are being cultivated. The medium is of middle condition or degree, mediocre. It lies in the middle of everything, between a man and his neighbor, his wife, his child, his self. It, more than anything else, is the substance through which the forces of society act upon us and make us into what our society needs. And what does our society need? It needs for us to need. In the year that John F. Kennedy staked out America's claims to a new frontier, Gerald claimed that in America, the frontier of necessity, which I think is a wonderful phrase, the frontier of necessity is always being pushed forward. The medium shows us what our new needs are, and it shows us how they can be satisfied. They can be satisfied by buying something. The act of buying something is at the root of our world. If anyone wishes to paint the genesis of things in our society, he will paint a picture of God holding out to Adam a checkbook or credit card or charge a plate. How quickly our poor naked Adam is turned into a consumer is linked to others by the great chain of buying. Now, if you remember earlier on, I said that the medium gets between the middle of everything, between a man and his neighbor, his wife, his child, his self. And I want to talk a little bit about that, how the medium can get between a person and themselves. And I think the way that it works is that essentially the medium gives us images with which we always compare ourselves to all kinds of detrimental effects. When I was a kid growing up, I was as tall as I am now, but I was about 20 pounds lighter. So I was kind of the conventional 90-pound weakling. And, you know, at a sort of a body like Jim Frederick's has now. And you have that body in this culture, and if you're a man, that's not the right body. You want to have a body that's built. So I did actually send off for the Charles Atlas thing one time, just, you know, the thing that was in the back of the comic books, and they sent back a thing saying that I'd have to send $100 or something like that to get the full program. But they described the philosophy of it, which was the philosophy of dynamic tension, which has been a useful kind of metaphor for me all my life, even though I wasn't able to get the fitness stuff, as you can see, still being sort of ectomorphic here. But that's one way that it works. Jarrell, writing in 1960, uses the idea of it being between a man and himself, but I want to suggest also the medium comes between a woman and herself, because it consistently invites her to compare herself to an ideal of beauty. Almost all pictures in print advertising are retouched, so that the medium asks women to compare themselves to the airbrushed perfection of models whose figures embody, literally, an ideal unattainable to about 95% of female human beings. Currently, models average 23% less in weight than the average woman. The results of this sort of coming between a woman and herself include self-scrutiny, self-questioning, loss of self-esteem. The 17 magazine once published an ad in a trade magazine, which is where they're trying to invite people to put ads in there. And the title of the thing that they published for advertisers was Insecurity as a Selling Tool. And in many ways, this is what the medium does for us, is to create insecurity in us and then use it to sell us back things. And then to alleviate the problem that in many ways they've created, halitosis, for example, bad breath, was created by Listerine in the late 1920s in order to sell Listerine. Companies sell the arbitrary and artificial beauty back to women, including $33 billion annually on diets and weight loss, $7 billion on cosmetics, and $300 million on cosmetic surgery. One woman at Holden told me yesterday that the United States spends more on diets than on all of its contributions to all world hunger programs, private and public. Few ads say it as explicitly as Nike and Foot Locker did once. You've got to be young and beautiful to be loved. This is part of our educational system, and girls learn these lessons early. Female teens average $506 a year on cosmetics and beauty salon visits. Most wear makeup by 13, and 26% wear perfume every day. Jarrell cited Emerson's idea that things are in the saddle and ride mankind, but he added that now they are in the theater and the studio and entertain mankind, are in the pulpit and preach to mankind. The values of business in a business society like our own are reflected in every sphere. Values which agree with them are reinforced. Values which disagree are canceled out or have lip service paid to them. Television is probably the best contemporary example of the mediation and mediocrity of the consumption ethic and business values. Television is the force through which a force acts or an effect is transmitted. It is the nutritive substance, although substance may not be exactly the right word, which cultivates Americans. Roughly 98% of Americans watch some TV every day. So if you don't, you're a deviant. As an average American, sleep is your primary lifetime activity. Work is second, but watching television is third. The average American watches about 7 nonstop years in a lifetime. Average daily household viewing time in 1989 was more than 7 hours. On the average, you watch TV more than you eat, more than any other leisure activity, and more than any religious or political activity. A 1986 Roper poll found that watching television is the most eagerly anticipated daily activity of 25% of Americans. Between the ages of 5 and 18, average American kids spend 11,000 hours in classrooms, quite an education, but they spend 19,000 hours in front of television, where they see 10,000 acts of violence and 350,000 commercials. Television is our main educational system. Schools are basically extracurricular. And your attitude toward TV makes no statistical difference. People who dislike TV watch on the average as much as those who like it. And people who complain about TV programming still turn on the TV, not so much to watch a particular show as to just, quote, watch TV. In some cases, watching TV overlaps with sleep, as a 1975 survey showed that 1/5 of all viewers claim that they watch TV and sleep at the same time. Brain research shows how it is possible to sleep and watch TV at the same time. Researchers have found that when people watch TV, within 30 seconds, the brain waves switch from predominantly beta waves, indicating alert and conscious attention, to predominantly alpha waves, indicating an unfocused, receptive lack of attention. The brain's left hemisphere, which processes information logically and analytically, tunes out while the person is tuned in to TV. Now, this is an especially curious fact because at its root, the word watch means, quote, the act of keeping awake and alert in order to look after, protect, or guard. Now, what would happen if we watched TV in this root or radical sense? What would happen if we looked at TV as a medium, as a means, agency, or instrumentality, and asked, for what? What are the ends for which TV is a means? When I ask my students why we have TV, I usually get two answers, entertainment and information. Following Jarrell's example, I consult my dictionary and find that entertain comes from roots meaning to hold between, and that it commonly means to hold the attention of, to divert, to amuse. This only provokes more questions. Who is diverting my attention? From what and why? I look up inform, because information is the second thing we're supposed to get from TV, and find that its primary meaning is to give form or character to be the formative principle of. This is what Jarrell suspected from the start, that TV informs the American people, that it makes us what we are, and that it diverts our attention from the way that it performs this information. But we still don't know the ends for which TV is the means. So let's ask why we are entertained and informed. Why are programs like 60 Minutes or Seinfeld or All My Children on the air? They are there to hold our attention, to hold us between. Between what? Between the ads. We normally think of TV ads as what we put up with to get the programs, but the people who pay for TV think differently. They think of programming as what they have to put up with to get you to watch the ads. To state it another way, the programs are ads for the commercials. In fact, one TV critic suggests that the programs are just there to keep the ads from bumping together. Now I just heard the week before I came here that there's going to be an all-ad station on cable TV. That's all they're going to run is ads. But we already have infomercials, which are half-hour ads, and some stations run those most of the day during the daytime. Indeed, when you think of TV as a medium, the programming is almost insignificant, except as it programs us to watch the ads. In fact, TV stations and networks are basically in the business of renting an audience, that's you, of potential consumers to advertisers. That's what TV is about. Television is more demographic than democratic, as critic Les Brown explains. How much an advertiser pays for a 30-second spot depends not so much on how many viewers tune in, but on the quality of those viewers, affluent young adults being preferred. Women between 18 and 49, for example, watching during prime time on Fridays, sell for $16.50 a thousand. Older women and teenagers who buy less sell for less. And that's why Nielsen ratings are important. We see the Nielsens in the paper every week and think of them as telling us what programs we should watch if we want to get into coffee break conversations the next day. But the Nielsens are the network's way of knowing what they can charge the advertisers. The Nielsens are how television watches us watching television. In 1977, the number one show was Happy Days, with an average weekly audience of 52 million people, 22 million of whom were in the prime spending 18 to 49 group. ABC charged advertisers $60,000 for 30 seconds of time, and that doesn't cost the count of the commercial, the cost of the commercial itself. By 1986, 30 seconds of prime time was $118,000. In 1992, it was up to $196,000. And what's even more interesting than that is that most 30-second and 60-second commercials cost more to make than the half-hour programs they allegedly sponsor. In fact, they cost as much as 10 times as much as a, the programs are really only 22 minutes long because you have to have 8 minutes of stuff in there. But a single 30-second commercial usually costs 10 times more than the 22 minutes of programming that you're watching. And in a way, you can see that, they're better. I mean, the ads are really good. Performance value of them is higher than many of the shows that we watch. If you want to read about this for an older kind of commercial, read Michael Arlen's book called 30 Seconds. It's a whole book on the making of AT&T's first Reach Out and Touch Someone commercial. And what AT&T was trying to do with that commercial was to make long distance acceptable as a kind of fun thing. Until that time, long distance had a very negative reputation. It was what you got a long distance call if your mom died or something like that. It was mainly for bad news. And so they were trying to transform people's images of long distance. And so they did this Reach Out and Touch Someone commercial. To do that, they shot 10,000 feet of film, and they ended up using about 50 of it for the final commercial. And so in a way, the ads are the real quality TV, if quality TV is not an oxymoron. Historically, advertising and television have helped to adapt Americans to an age of affluence. Said motivation researcher Ernest Dichter in the early 50s, we are now confronted with the problem of permitting the average American to feel moral even when he's spending, even when he's not saving, even when he is taking two or three vacations a year and buying a second or third car. One of the basic problems of prosperity, then, is to demonstrate that the hedonistic approach to life is a moral, not an immoral one. And television was the ideal medium for solving this problem of permission. In their brilliant book on American politics and everyday life, and that's the title of it, Robert Holdsworth and Harry Ray suggest that the average American family is exposed to at least 1,600 ads a day, not just on TV, and that these advertisements have significant implications for American political culture. Even though we do not react to each ad that we see, we react to the system of advertising, to what Michael Schudson calls capitalist realism. Capitalist realism is a phrase that he uses to compare it to socialist realism. Socialist realism is a kind of art that was popular in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 1930s, showing these big, burly workers working for Mother Russia and women doing the same thing. And we look at that as sort of sheer propaganda for the Soviet way of life. But what Schutzen says is that ads, as a whole, are capitalist realism and a kind of propaganda for our way of life, not paid for by the government, but paid for by what you might contend, the people that really run the country anyway, which is the people who can buy time on TV. And as a consequence, as Holdsworth and Ray say, we expect deceit in public discourse, and we get it. We therefore become cynical of public communication and of politicians and public figures. They also say that the persistent pull of advertising in the consumer society is towards self-doubt and privatization. The emphasis on a self which identifies being as consuming draws attention away from more genuine resolution of social problems. In a consumer culture, the deck is stacked against public goods in part because the system of private acquisition is incessantly sold. What would happen, they say, if we switch things around? Instead of watching 1,600 ads for things that you can privately buy to make your particular life better, if all you got was 1,600 public service ads, What would life be like? What if 1,600 ads invited you to be part of community in some way or another, or to spend some time telling stories, or to do a whole variety of other things? It gives you an idea of, in a way, how compelling the 1,600 ads that we now get are, to think about what the alternative would be. Of course, now, if we did the alternative and had 1,600 public service ads, we would call that propaganda. But we don't call the 1,600 ads that we currently get propaganda most of the time. They also suggest that the values of advertising in consumer society directly affect politics in ads, where candidates make the same sorts of claims as advertisers do for commercial products. Read my lips, the ads say. Image sells better than substance. And the best example of that I know is a thing that I mentioned last week. It's a public broadcasting series that Bill Moyers did probably in the late 80s, called The Public Mind, four-part series. And in that, they show really the marketing of Ronald Reagan in the 1984 election. They have Michael Deaver on there, who was his campaign manager, saying explicitly, "We sold him like a bar of soap." And some of the ways that they do that is with focus groups to find out what it is that people want to hear. And the most interesting thing to me was one where they have a TV rigged up to show Reagan giving a speech, and they have an audience in a room watching the TV, and they ask the members of the audience to hold buttons and to push the buttons faster as they hear things that they like. And then on the TV that Deaver is watching, they have it set up so that you can see a bar graph in front of Reagan's face moving up and down as the audience responds to what he says. And so they can know exactly when he says the word neighborhood, boom, this is one that you want to repeat over and over and over again. And they find what all the buzzwords are that people will respond to. And Reagan was a master of communication. I mean, it was not just a dumb mastery of communication. It was a highly crafted, highly researched kind of communication that he was doing. The last thing politically that happens because of ads is that political opposition gets culturally co-opted by ads. Advertisers love to take a social movement and then sort of sell a product by using the social movement. The You've Come a Long Way, Baby is a good example of that. The 60s was sold with long hair, beads, bells, everything but the substance was sold back to people at the end of the 1960s. Civil rights was sold in the 1960s as Black is Beautiful. And all kinds of surface visions of what that meant, with none of the substance left. Now, advertising requires a certain kind of show, a certain kind of setting. A vice president of programming for ABC revealed that, quote, "program makers are supposed to devise and produce shows that will attract mass audiences without unduly offending those audiences or too deeply moving them emotionally. Such ruffling, it is thought, will interfere with the ability to receive, recall, and respond to the commercial message." This programming reality is the unwritten, unspoken assumption of all professional members of the television fraternity. So in a way, what this is saying is that you have to have trivial and insignificant shows, because if you had shows that were more substantive, you would notice that the ads are trivial and insignificant. And if the ads are the primary programming and you want to have trivial and insignificant ads, then you've got to have trivial and insignificant programming to go along with it. I've only seen one instance on TV of a program that was not trivial and insignificant, and it actually had this shock value on me. Probably, again, in the 1980s, there was a show on CBS, I think, called Playing for Time, in which I think it was Vanessa Redgrave played a concentration camp internee who could play who had orchestral skills, and it turned out that the German commander of this concentration camp liked orchestral music. And so as long as she kept playing, he would keep her alive. As long as she could keep the orchestra going, he would keep her alive. And you see her getting more and more gaunt and essentially starving to death, but staying alive by playing this music, really being, you know, also aesthetically involved in the music, but playing for time. Incredible tragedy going on here. And there were, unfortunately, two ads in this that were just entirely out of place. One was for the American Natural Gas Association. Just the juxtaposition of these people being gassed to death and the American National Gas Association did not work. I don't think they sold very much natural gas as a result of this. And the other one was that they had an ad in this program for one of these creams that will take spots off your skin. Sort of like, now, you know, here we are, this person's playing for time, playing for her life, but we need to know how to keep spots off of our skin. Now, TV plays fantasies of a fascinating life at the same time that it makes our lives less fascinating. Why don't characters watch TV on TV? Because it would be boring to watch what we do all the time. Now, I want to talk about the other part of TV, which is the informative side of it, and TV news. Now, because the news holds us between the ads as well as any other show, the news is also entertainment in the root sense of the word. It also holds us between. And the news is informative, forming us within, even if we don't learn very much from it. Normally, a half-hour network news show contains 15 to 20 stories, averaging 60 seconds each. These quick capsule stories are hard to remember. Studies show that most people forget the news within 30 minutes. I'm sorry. We have that much memory anyhow. The stories are hard to think about since we get so little so fast. They're even harder to feel about since the same music frames the show every day, the station breaks, the commercials, regardless of a particular day's news. And it's hard for us to know what's really important since all of the stories receive about the same amount of coverage. An in-depth story on, say, the nighttime news is 180 seconds. That's the amount that you get. And an entire news show, if you took an entire news show and put it in print, it wouldn't fill the front page of most newspapers. So we think that we're getting a lot of information from TV news, but in fact, there isn't much there. Consequently, the news affects us most superficially. We keep up with the news as a sort of civic duty, but we seldom do anything about it. In his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman asks, how often does it occur that information provided you on morning radio or television or in the morning newspaper causes you to alter your plans for the day? Sometimes weather does that. Occasionally stocks, if you've got investments and the market is falling or something like that. But for most of us, the news is just inert information, useful for the trivial pursuit of conversation, but not for any meaningful action. In the past 50 years, TV has changed what Postman calls the information-action ratio. As we get more and more information about things we can't affect, you know, when that jet crashes in Florida, why do I need to know that? Is that useful information to me? No, I think not. What's important about that jet thing is that it's sort of great TV, and it will make a lot of people sit there and wait for the ads to come on. And that's why it's there. So TV loves things that have images, and the image of a bunch of people digging in a swamp for an airplane that's underneath is pretty good for TV. So everything has become everybody's business through the news, and consequently, no one is responsible for it. But network news shows contain something else that we can respond to, 15 to 20 commercials, averaging about 30 seconds each. While the news is fragmented and discontinuous, the commercials mediate a single message, buy something. As a counterpoint to the complexity of life, they offer simple solutions to understandable problems and proclaim the message that a purchase, any purchase, spells relief. And it's real interesting to watch the news and see who advertises on the news. There are a lot of pain relievers advertised on the news, sort of like, here, the world is falling apart, now have some Tylenol, or something like that. Or one year when my students were watching it, Whirlpool was advertising a new, very quiet dishwasher, and the slogan that they were using was, making your world a little easier. Again, sort of, here's the world, it's falling apart, but this dishwasher will make your world a little bit easier. Other messages also come through on TV news. One is that if you want to be interviewed as an expert, it helps to be a white male representative of government, the military, or a major corporation. A 1980 study of ABC's Nightline found that 92% of the guests were white, 89% were men. Of 19 guests who were on five times or more, all were men, and 13 were part of or close to the Reagan administration. So mostly TV news speaks with the voice of power. Thus, TV news is not as informative as we think, except as it informs us about our needs. One reason for this is that the news never comes in historical context, since by definition, the news is only what's new. That's why the best example of this that I can remember is the Iran hostage crisis of 1979, where we got a daily count on the hostages, and they were there for 444 days, and the news on most days was nothing happened. So let's talk about this for 3 minutes. And Nightline actually was invented to go with that crisis, and so not only did you get, say, 2 or 3 minutes about the nothing that happened during the news, but then you get a half hour with Ted Koppel about the nothing that happened after that. And none of that, almost none of it, had any reference at all to the CIA coup that installed the Shah in Iran in the 1950s. Almost all of it was day-to-day. Here's what happened. Here's what we think might happen tomorrow. Here's what people are doing. Here they're flying into the desert and all of that sort of thing. And what we get on TV news is what Neil Postman calls decontextualized information. And essentially, I want to contend that decontextualized information is trivia. And since then, we have all this trivia in our minds, and since I'll suggest on Wednesday that we get a lot more trivia in school because it also tends to be decontextualized information. We have lots and lots of trivia and lots of this decontextualized information. So what we do is we create contexts that make sense of the decontextualized information that we have. And Trivial Pursuit is that. It's a context for all the clutter in our minds that we have that means absolutely nothing unless you can put it in a game format and get those little slices and move around there and stuff like that. Game shows are the same thing. Jeopardy is a context for the decontextualized information that we get in our lives as Americans. Now, Jarrell saw this lack of perspective as an integral part of the American medium. Our culture, he said, is essentially periodical. We believe that all that is deserves to perish and to have something else put in its place. We speak about planned obsolescence, but it is more than planned. It is felt. It is an assumption about the nature of the world. We believe that the present is better and more interesting, more real than the past, and that the future will be better and more interesting, more real than the present. Our standards have become, to an astonishing degree, the standards of what is called the world of fashion, where mere timeliness, being orange in orange's year, violet in violet's, is the value to which all other values are reducible. Jarrell contended that all this is, at bottom, the opposite of the world of the arts, where commercial and scientific progress do not exist, where the past, the remote past even, is responsible for the way we understand, value, and act in the present. An artist's life and work presuppose continuing standards, values extended over centuries or millennia, a future that is a continuation and modification of the past, not its contradiction or irrelevant replacement. In our periodical culture, the possibility of comprehensible illusion, another phrase that I like a lot, the possibility of comprehensible illusion is destroyed because we only know the present and we can't understand or appreciate that because we don't know the past. For example, when Jarrell suggested, as I read earlier, that the act of buying is at the root of our world, if anyone wishes to paint the genesis of things in our society, he will paint a picture of God holding out to Adam a checkbook or credit card or charger plate. How many of us missed his reference to Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel and his implicit comparison of the sort of cosmic order of that and the purposefulness of that with the kind of credit card that we have there. That's comprehensible illusion. He expects his readers to be able to know that. And then a little bit later in the passage, how many of us missed the implicit and devastating comparison between or when Jarrell noted how quickly our poor naked Adam is turned into a consumer, is linked to others by the great chain of buying. How many of us missed seeing that the great chain of buying was not just the supermarket, but a reference to the philosophical idea of the great chain of being in which creator and creatures were linked in a meaningful cosmic order? That's what the possibility of comprehensible illusion can do for you. It can kind of make a kind of density to your thinking and your language. In America, the medium does lock us into a meaningful cosmic order, but it is an order contrived by commercial culture, and it subverts traditional values to promote those values that will get us to buy into what Daniel Boorstin calls consumption communities. Another phrase I like a lot, consumption communities that bind us only by our buying. Boorstin would say that a consumption community is the community of people who drink Coke, for example, or the community of people who drive Buicks, or the community of people who wear a certain brand of clothes. And that's one form of community that we have in American life. As part of the moral ecology of everyday life, television has contradictory meanings and effects. Richard Flack suggests that TV is a medium of sociability and also an escape from the strains of interpersonal encounter. It allows family members to be together, but it reduces the need for them to deal with each other. It has made available cheaply a tremendous range of professional entertainment and culture, and thus reduces the boredom and loneliness faced by people with few material resources. And it's important to remember that TV does do some good things. TV is TV watching is highest among low-income people who may not be able to afford other forms of entertainment, and is also high among older people who can't move around a lot. So TV does provide some kinds of entertainment like that. It is at the same time incontrovertibly a vast wasteland of trivia and vulgarity whose emotional impact is similar to other forms of cheap self-indulgence. It provides an opportunity for choice and control over one's experience, as you can change the channels, while it represents a form of controlled leisure and consumption that, more than any other packaged mode of entertainment, erases initiative and undermines imagination. And it has real effects on people. George Gerbner, the dean of the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications, shows that heavy watchers of primetime TV receive a grossly distorted picture of the real world that they tend to accept more readily than reality itself. It's what he calls the mean world syndrome. For example, on primetime TV, men outnumber women 3-1, and women are generally still typecast as lovers or mothers, passive people dependent on their relationship to men. Only 20% of married women with children work in TV land versus 50% in the real world. And these skewed perceptions, says Gerbner, reinforce sexism. Heavy TV watchers tend to be more sexist than people who don't watch as much. The same patterns hold for depictions of old age, for treatments of black people, for the depiction of work, where you mainly see largely managerial professional class work, for fear of crime, which is 10 times more common on TV than in everyday life. 55% of primetime characters are involved in violence once a week, and heavy watchers of TV have unrealistic expectations of victimization. What we think is simply light entertainment has some fairly heavy effects. It also has effects on the way that we see nature, especially like nature programs on TV. Bill McKibben in The Age of Missing Information says that essentially what nature programs show you on TV is usually the uncharacteristic moments of largely mammals who are more or less like human beings. So the more anthropocentric the animal is, the more likely they are to watch it. There aren't a whole lot of programs on insects, for example, on TV. And what you see about these animals is the moments when they're moving, because TV is about moving pictures. So, for example, a special on lions or tigers shows you always them in motion, but in fact, lions lay down and sleep about 23 hours a day. And again, it would be like having TV of us watching TV. It would be boring to see what animals really do. So what we get is the kind of highlight films of animal things. So the TV is the creation is presented to us in anthropocentric terms that make it difficult to see the whole story. If TV were to make the Book of Genesis into a miniseries, says McKibben, people would be created on day one, and Noah's Ark would be filled with zany folks. Not much room for animals, especially the boring ones. On TV, people are everything. Most cultures historically have put something else, God or nature or some combination, at the center, but we've put God and nature at the periphery. A consumer society doesn't need them to function, and it can't tolerate the limits that they might impose. There's only need for people. As America's primary educational institution, television teaches us that our extravagant and excessive patterns of consumption are perfectly normal. One other thing that TV does for us is it makes us passive. And when I talk about passivism on Saturday, this is one of the things that it does. I have some more here, but I think it's time for me to listen to you. You've listened to me a long time. Thank you for that. You're attuned to it from having watched a lot of TV.
One of the things on newscast is now, you know, every 15 minutes or whatever, you've got a summary of what you're going to
All right.
be hearing. And I swear the story is probably 3 seconds longer than the summary. I mean, it's just...
Right, coming up next. In fact, coming up next is their way of making you sit through the ad. They put the it's called the hook, and they try to hook you at the beginning with that summary and preview in order to get you to sit through the ad rather than changing
like
the channel.
Less and less of anything meaningful.
Right. I actually had a student in the Para College several years ago who decided to see if she could do the news as well as CBS did, and what she did was she taped a CBS Evening News thing with Dan Rather and watched the news. And then she, and it was all decontextualized information. There was a story on, this was in the 80s, there was a story on Nicaragua, there was a story on El Salvador, there was a another story in another Central American country, I can't remember what it was, but they were all presented at different times and places in the newscast. And they had no sort of unifying theme, like the United States is connected to these countries in certain ways that might be called imperial, for example. That was not connected there. And so what Ann did was to sort of restructure the news, contextualize it, bring some history in the history of American involvement in Latin America, present the same information in context, do the whole thing in 22 minutes. Then she got a suit and dressed up and presented this news, and she also did ads, sort of mock ads for the other 8 minutes of the thing to fill them in. And the ads that she did were brilliant too. In the Twin Cities, there's a guy who sells for Viking Chevrolet, who's one of these really loud, obnoxious salesmen. Come right in, buy this Viking Chevrolet today. Well, her brother was a paraplegic, and so he had always wanted to do one of these for his wheelchair. And he did. He did that. And it was also an Olympic year. It must have been 1984. It was an Olympic year, and all the Olympic ads were on. And so she had one for the official menstrual cycle of the Olympics. It was also wonderful. And she had another one where she was flashing a phone number on for people to call in and buy stuff. And it was my home telephone that was flashing. But she did much, much better than CBS News did. It took her about a week to do it because she didn't have the resources of CBS News. But if they wanted to, they could produce news that would give us information. But it's not profitable for them to do that, I think. And you can see the difference between who watches them and who watches McNeil-Lehrer. McNeil-Lehrer generally do spend time to contextualize information, and for the most part, most of us think it's dull.
Jim? When you said it took her a week to do that, that does raise the question about how television is on a really tight deadline. Right. And certainly there are these economic factors that are going on, but I wonder if there are also some time constraints about the ability to contextualize the news.
No.
Would it just have to do with who they hired?
It has to do with what they consider news. And essentially what they consider news is events, discrete things that have happened on this particular day. The real news in our culture, though, is not events. The real news in our culture is processes. The real news in our culture is not individual. Usually they want to put an individual on there so they can show a face moving or something like that. The real news in our culture is sociological and ecological.
Right.
And those things you can't get good pictures for most of the
right.
time. They're slow processes.
Right. But if you had those processes in mind, then you could each day fill the stories into those processes,
right.
and over time you would show.
And in fact, if you really wanted to inform people, what you would do is have those processes in mind and look for stories that illustrate the processes rather than the thing that happens to have the best footage. I mean, why are there so damn many fires on TV, for example? You know, for the most part, when a building burns down, I can't do anything about it because, you know, it burned down 100 miles from where I am or even across the world. But fires are great visual footage because it's moving and it's flaming and it's colorful.
It's big.
And there's a human element to it too, usually some kind of tragedy or something like that. They don't generally show us very much of, say, forests burning down. It tends to be someplace where people live, and then you've got to have the people standing outside crying and stuff like that, and some reporter walking up to them and saying, "How do you feel?"
I was up here in 94 when there were huge fires in this area,
right.
in the Navarre Coulee, which is how we drive to get to Wenatchee, you know. Well, we couldn't get any news,
right?
They're trying to monitor the AM station to be able to tell people whether or not you'll be able to get off the boat at Fields Point. But people in Pennsylvania are watching CNN,
right.
seeing this huge fire. They thought, and people didn't come to Holden because they thought, oh, God, Holden Village is on fire. Well, the village wasn't on fire, but there's this real skewing that the people who needed to know something didn't, and people who didn't need to know knew something wrong.
Yeah. That's pretty much the way it works.
Yeah.
Just about everything you said about TV is bad. Is there anything that you can say about it that's good?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that I was talking to somebody today who was saying that, you know, after you've really worked hard during the day, you want something that's utterly relaxing, and often TV does that for you. Some of the shows, I think, are really quite good, are very, very clever kinds of shows.
Well, aside from the three national broadcasting channels, but What about the public broadcasting, the National Geographic?
I do think public broadcasting is really quite good, but the audience for it is very, very small. And I think that we ought to do more things like public broadcasting on commercial TV. But also, it's the case that public broadcasting is becoming more commercial. When you see the things that they used to do 15 years ago, they would say, you know, mobile presents X. Now it's you get about three or four lines about mobile. And there's this book, actually, I should pass around, too. It's called Marketing Madness, A Survival Guide for a Consumer Society by Michael Jacobson and Laurie Mazur. There's a chapter in here on public radio and TV, which shows the ways in which sponsors are able to influence what gets shown, even on public TV.
Are there any critiques of television that recommend to certain programs are worthwhile, educational?
I don't think people generally pick particular programs for that. I really find a lot of what's on public TV to be quite interesting.
For instance, are there any recommendations for parents so far as what children should watch, what programs are available?
It's really tough to say that because the best known children's program that's supposed to be educational is Sesame Street. But Sesame Street is useful in many ways for helping students learn information. But Sesame Street also has its problems. It's one of the fastest cutting shows on TV. It's almost like MTV in the speed of its cuts, which tends to make things discontinuous and very fast. And it means that elementary school teachers have to compete with the speed of MTV and the amusement, or not MTV, of Sesame Street. And it also, I've seen some stuff on Sesame Street that suggests that it reinforces the major values of American culture. So they always have stores and things on there, and so people are buying things, which says basically
this is... positive recommendations concerning television?
The positive recommendation that I would watch is that parents ought to watch TV with their kids. And then you can watch just about anything, but you need to be talking about it when the TV is on. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially the strategy I've adopted. There's some things I won't let my kids watch, but there are a lot of things that if they really want to watch it, I'll say, well, I'll watch that with you, and we'll talk about it as we go on. And I tend to be, actually being in American Studies is a disadvantage for them. They hate it when the ads come on and they say, you know, and actually they want to watch the ads. You know, we think during the ads we can get them to come and do a little bit of housework or something like that. The ads are more interesting to them because they're better TV. And it's hard to pull them away from that. But you have to keep reminding them what's going on there. So I think you could do a lot of education with TV, but it doesn't come from watching particular programs, I think.
What's the motivation then for the networks to do commercial-free TV? You know, a couple of examples, you know, to bridge commercials. For example, you'll see maybe a political convention and there'll be, you know, no commercials for a period of time, or a weather channel. Of course, really purely information. There's no desire to communicate commercials. What's their motivation?
Well, part of
major networks do that with some of them.
Yeah, major networks do that, and they do it to make us feel good about them. It's what, I'll talk about this a little bit when I talk about shopping, it's what's called innocence by association. And it's a way of saying we're providing a public service at this particular time. Keep that in mind when you're putting up with all the rest of the dreck that we give you.
How about the Weather Channel?
The rest of the time. The Weather Channels that I see on cable are usually have ads. The local weather channel often doesn't, but then it's really an ad for the cable system because it's a way of getting you to know that information is available for you, I think. Jim?
It's such a huge problem. Content isn't the only issue, as you've touched on.
Right.
What it does to the brain waves and all that.
Right.
Jane Healy, in a book called Endangered Minds, I just read a quote from that, talking about kids who watch... really being hardwired, that the kind of stimulation received shapes the way your brain forms, so that kids are being hardwired into inattention and all those kinds of stuff that teachers are dealing with in schools. Since I don't know where you're going this week, but I leave today, so I'm bottom line, how do we as communities that want to have a different agenda or just want to develop an inner life and community life and all those kinds of things. I mean, how do we deal with this? So do we develop critical detachment from something that's inevitable, or do we become sort of Luddites or Hutterites or something, you know, detach ourselves totally from this culture and call people out into a wilderness of total non-TV?
My preference, and this is a personal preference, is to be in and out of the culture, to at the same time to adopt a kind of anthropological perspective where you're in the culture and at the same time able to be critical of it. So, you know, I watch TV, and there are times when I watch dumb TV. I was telling Dave this morning that our family has actually now got a ritual of watching America's Funniest Home Videos, which I think is one of the dumbest shows on TV. When it first came out, I thought it was the highlight of dumb shows on TV, that people would be willing to send in videos of themselves making fools of themselves. But by Sunday night, a lot of times, I've worked pretty hard over the weekend, and all I want to do is laugh. And I can pretty predictably get a couple of good laughs out of America's Funniest Home Videos. So I'll watch an utterly stupid show for that reason. And we watch it together, so it's kind of a family ritual now, and I'm not sure whether there's any benefit to that or not, but it's probably better than all four of us watching it individually on different TVs. So I can think that there are some benefits of that. I think my kids have learned something about TV by me always harping on them about this or that and setting limits on the amount of time that they can watch and saying you have to make choices about which, if you're going to watch this much in the morning, then you're not going to watch any at night, and the program that you might want to watch at night is this. And then we always sort of, we always break the rules on time if they want to watch something on PBS because it usually is better.
There was in school, it was the spring, and a little kindergarten child came up. It's great to watch the TV with your children, but when the TV's constantly on and it's just there, and a little boy came up, his teacher was trying to get him to do something, the kindergarten child. And he says, well, I don't have to do that. She goes, well, yes, you do. You need to do this. And it, well, why? And she goes, well, it's going to help you when you grow up to be responsible or whatever she said. And he says, well, I don't have to do that because when I grow up, I'm going to watch TV. Oh. And he says, because my mom watches TV, her boyfriend watches TV, and that's all they do is watch TV. So I'm going to watch TV when I grow up. And then, and this is a kindergarten child that we're dealing, this has been, going through the school. Hopefully he'll be able to stay at this one particular school and be there. And she said, well, when I send these papers home, for your mother to help you, does she help you? She says, no, she watches TV. And so that's a culture, it's a cultural thing that we're dealing with.
Right, and that's even true for people like me who are critical of TV at times. My kids will learn more from the way I watch TV than from any amount of lessons that I try to give them when they're watching TV. So if I give them all those lessons when they're watching TV and I sit there and zone out for 3 hours a night, my educational lessons with them are going to have zero effect.
What is the effect of computers now? I find my grandchildren are being limited to the amount of time they
right
on the computer, and it's about the same as the television now.
Well, I don't know. If we ever have an air war, we're going to be in great shape because we're going to have all kinds of people with sort of eye-hand coordination. That's great for fighter pilots, I think. I think that two things, I think. I think most of the stuff that's on computers in terms of games is a waste of time, as much of a waste of time as TV. The one thing that can be said for computers is that at least my kids very seldom play the computer by themselves. And when they play with another kid there, they're almost always in conversation about strategies or something like that. And there may be something useful in that, but I don't know. And I actually, some adults play the games that their children are playing, but I've never been able to bring myself to do that. So I can't play any of these games. Every once in a while, when they want a real laugh, they asked me to play one of these games. So I get destroyed.
Being the owner of a computer, it's up to you what kind of software you want to put on it. So there's a lot of people that choose to let their kids play these games that have no worthwhile value.
Right.
But as the owner of the computer, if you learn to understand the computer enough, you can choose to put some fantastic things on it. Kids learn. I mean, I've grown up with computers in my house all my life, but I've always had stuff that have been really beneficial to my education, that being Word systems to
Word processing, right.
I mean, what a fantastic tool to be able to use and not abuse.
Right. Is there any software that you find particularly useful? Usually when I buy things that seem to me to be more sort of educational for my kids, they won't play it.
We have some great stuff.
Pardon me?
We have some great CDs that Darlene Kindersley makes. Really, they're a really good book publisher for informational stuff for kids. And my my son loves the Darlene Kindersley CDs.
Okay, and they're for younger kids?
They're for, he's 7, and I'd say he's kind of at the bottom of the age range. But before that, the Living Books are really fun for them. And,
Actually, the Living Books reminded me of somebody told me the other day that
1 minute.
We're going to put in 1 minute, just like TV. American Mind works by the half hour and the hour, in part because that's the way TV works. I heard somebody the other day talking about a grandmother whose grandchild was having a hard time reading, and what she suggested to him is that he should keep watching TV but keep the closed captioning on all the time. This would help his reading skills. We should have one more comment.
Hey, Jim?
Yeah.
You talked about television, but is the internet destined to go the same direction?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, people will have to make a lot of... Already there's so much junk out there. The person that invents a junk filter for the internet is going to be wealthier than the guy that owns Microsoft. Although, you know, junk means different things to different people. But for me, most of the time when I'm on the internet looking for stuff, I probably spend more time getting junk than I get real information that I want. And I think that will increase as it becomes more commercial. Well, stay tuned. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the 60s. Thanks.
Film at 11.
Film at 11.